This is Christopher, and you are listening to the Orphan Entertainment Podcast, the podcast dedicated to exploring the universe of public domain media. Joining me, as they often do, is...
Did you say joining fondue?
Joining me, as they often do, is the Boymar and Germar to my Droppo, oh my Lydia God. And Barry.
Hey, Merry Christmas, everyone.
Oh, my goodness.
Hi, guys. Thank you for joining me again.
Thanks for having us.
You.
All right. The film we have chosen for this festive time of year is that Yuletide classic from 1964, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
I know everybody's already seen it, so this will just be rehashing for you guys.
Yes. Yeah, we are one of many, many, many podcasts that have chosen to review and discuss this film, apparently.
Yeah, which is, well, you know, and then, of course, MST3K did it for one of their episodes. And
I think Riff Trax is doing it live in the theaters.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know that. The things you
I think they're doing it live, or it was either them or Cinematic Titanic, one of the two.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, this much maligned sci-fi holiday crossover, which often finds itself on the naughty list as one of the worst sci-fi films ever. And it does appear that it was a bit of a career killer for most of the cast.
I would say it was a career killer for everybody in the cast with one exception.
I wouldn't say that. There was a few. I had the only exceptions were being Vincent Beck, who plays the villain Vomar. He continues acting and is often seen as the villain and several times in monster makeup for many years after this. Bill McCutcheon, I think is how you say it, who plays Droppo. He actually went on to win an Emmy for work on Sesame Street.
Oh, I missed that.
Seriously. Really? Yeah. And then, of course, the young Pia Zadora, who made her film debut as the Martian daughter Germar. And, of course, she acted sporadically, appearing in things like Hairspray and Naked Gun 33 and a Third.
Now, I noticed that, but the one really remarkable name in this whole thing is going to be the guy who, I'm sorry, I don't have his name pulled up in front, but he is the news broadcaster for KID-TV. And he, you will recognize from the last Pirates of the Caribbean movie as the singing pirate.
Really? I believe you're talking about Ned Wertheimer?
Yes, that would be the one. I'm, of course, totally being facetious. That's the only thing of note, anything I recognize that he did. But he did have the longest list of, yeah, you know, the longest resume of everybody on there, I think.
I'll admit he's one of those people that I recognized and recognized his voice, but couldn't tell you from where. I doubt it was from any of the Pirates of the Caribbean. I'm guessing it was probably just.
Yeah, I looked up
I'm
his
guessing
CV
it was just
I,
some appearance somewhere. Yeah,
I looked up his CV and saw that and went, huh. Actually, that is the one. I mean, you know, aside from really old stuff like Dragnet and Gunsmoke and things like that, that was the only kind of modern, well-known thing that anybody from this movie did. So don't be surprised, gentle listeners, if you're watching this and you don't recognize anybody in it.
Yeah, exactly. This is not a movie where you're going to go, oh, and this person started their long industrious career. Yeah, no.
As an extra. Actually, you might say that.
Yeah, no, even I was even surprised. I mean, a lot of the kids other than Pia here did nothing. After this.
Or before. Both Billy and Betty, I think, are their names.
Yeah, I think this is their only
That's
screen credits.
It. Yeah, those are the only ones.
Yeah, and I noticed most of the other actors, they have like maybe one or two films before this and nothing after it.
With the exception of Mrs. Claus, who had a whole long list before that, and then it just, boom, cuts off at the end of
yeah.
Santa Claus, you know.
So apparently Santa Claus conquers the Screen Actors Guild.
I'm amazed anybody found work after this movie.
Now, okay, I actually, you weren't expecting this, but I am going to defend this movie just a little bit. Obviously,
really?
From the beginning, and obviously it has this really horrible reputation, and of course the acting is dreadful, but it's so obviously a movie that was intended for children. And I think a lot of the time that gets overlooked. But one of the very first things that happens is, you know, you have these Martian children watching TV and the channel they're watching is KID-TV, which I didn't pick up the first time I saw it years ago. But this time, obviously paying attention to it for the podcast, I went, oh, well, of course it's awful. It's just, you know, everything from the 1960s is awful, but especially anything made for children has that extra step of awfulness for it, you know. Actually, I'm sure I'm going to get in trouble for saying everything from the 1960s is awful. Everything we've reviewed from the 1960s, let's put it that way. But it really is intended for kids. So a lot of the slapstick, a lot of the jokes, they're really corny. But, you know, it's a movie made in the 60s that was trying to gear toward a kind of more innocent age and specifically toward children. It's not as bad when you take that into consideration. I'm not saying it's good.
I'm with you, Lydia. I'm amazed. I'm surprised that you stepped up first, because I was honestly going to do the same. I really, if you look at this as just a kid's movie, mm-hmm. I mean, it as a sci-fi film, of course, it's absolute rubbish. And even as a Christmas movie, I think it fails a little bit. But I mean, as just entertainment for a kid, I think it does just fine.
It really, you know, it's diverse enough. It has enough going on that it can keep a kid's attention. It doesn't talk over their heads, which, you know, a lot of kids' movies now do. They do really talk over kids' heads with the intent of, you know, engaging adults. But that's not something that was a goal back in the 60s. They weren't saying, oh, well, we want to make this appeal to as broad of an audience as possible, keep the kids' attention with bright colors and, you know, lots of action, but then also keep the adults entertained with, you know, sharp wit and good dialogue. They didn't do that back then. It was very much geared toward one or the other. You didn't so much have, I mean, you had a few family movies, but mostly it seemed to be really, you know, that separation of adult movies or kid movies. And this definitely falls in the kid movie category.
Yep, absolutely.
Now that
I'm not
going to
completely disagree with you guys, but I got to point something out. First of all, I agree with you both in the sense that if I was a child watching this, I probably would have found it very diverting when I was 6 or 7 years old, because it is so full of color and it never stops moving and it is so bizarrely watchable. You're right about that, but I got to bring this up, Lydia. You mentioned the opening scene in which bad TV is rotting the brains of the Martian children. I got to say, that's more irony than this movie can handle.
I almost think that was unintentional. I think this was not in a period of time where they had 24-hour television. I could be mistaken about that, but
you're right.
I think, you know, up through the mid-60s, they didn't broadcast just 24/7 like we do now, you know, and so it was less of an issue than it is now. We don't, you know, you didn't have kids sitting in front of Teletubbies for 6 hours a day, but, you know, it was. And even the kid programs that are supposed to be rotting their brains, take into account these are Martians who don't laugh, they don't play. All they do is learn all day. So, wow, that rhymed totally on accident.
But, that was beautiful.
Thank you. I try. Actually, I don't. But, you know, there should be, what is it? They plug them into their learning machines, I think is what it calls them later.
Yes.
And they just learn all day. So I think that they're trying to make a statement about the Martian culture more than a statement about, you know, TV itself. But I think that weirdly it turned out as that kind of ironic statement where we today would look at that and go, oh, yeah, totally rotting kids' brains. But back then it wasn't necessarily a real concern. Wow.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they went for the social commentary, or if they did, I'm not sure exactly which one they went for, or if they really tried to hit both. There was the look at TV rotting the kid's brain, but then, of course, like you were saying, there's also the, you know, all work and no play is bad. And,
well, it really,
you know, you hit that.
Yeah, well, it really could have just also been a plot device to introduce the kids.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, really, to say, okay, well, we have to come up with some way to get the parents to talk to the kids. I know, let's have them complain about the kids and what they're doing. I mean, if we could find the writer, if we could dig up the writer, no pun intended, sorry.
That's something, you know, that probably often happens is people try to read so much into these films when they get to be 30, 40 years old. And there are probably many writers that sit there and go, Jesus, we just made crap up. You know, we don't know.
Yeah, it's that Finding Forrester, that classic, you know, Field of Dreams, was it? And he's like, I don't want to talk to you about the symbolism in the book. It's not, I just wrote a book, you know, and I think that's the same thing. I'm sure they were just like, okay, well, we have to have some kind of a scene for this opening, and here's the dialogue. In other words, exactly. Barry, you're wrong. No.
I'm not giving this movie any intellectual credit at all, so you two go ahead. You two go ahead and, like, figure out what the wizard behind the curtain is, because I don't see any wizard here.
All I'm saying is I think that it's not as bad when you take into account it's not really meant to entertain the masses. It was probably, I would think, created as a Saturday morning kids special. You know, that kind of thing where it's, hey, let's stick the kids in front of the TV for an hour and a half so that we can get the gardening done.
Yeah, I think that this still falls in the realm of movies and television where I'm sure there are many filmmakers and that look back on this now and go, God, I really thought that was only going to show for a month at the Bijou and then seen again. You know,
and it became this cult thing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I have to think that probably went into a lot of actors' choices to go, yeah, fine, I got to eat, so I'll do
right.
it. You know, because they didn't expect to have to be living it down for the next 40 years.
Right. I mean, they show this thing every December. I mean, it's probably, I mean, if we were to do the numbers, this is probably one of those films like the original Christmas Carol and 1983's A Christmas Story. Every December, people, millions and millions of people worldwide watch this film in one way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm. Well,
exactly.
And if you think about the number of this kind of movie that have been lost, but we don't, you know, that this happened to survive on film somewhere, you know, and there are, I'm sure, dozens, if not hundreds or thousands of movies that were just as bad when they were made. And just, you know, somebody at some point looked at the celluloid and said, hey, we can use that somewhere else. Let's burn it or let's recycle it or whatever. You know, it's all, I think, probably a fluke of fate.
Yeah. Luck of the draw. It's just a. Well, should we talk a little bit about the plot of the film?
Actual movie. Let's do that.
I was just thinking about your statement, Chris. It was so thoughtful and like reflective of like how so many of these films are lost. And then I thought, you know, so many of Orson Welles' great films gone, but thank God we've got Dropo the Martian.
Right? Or, you know, half of Doctor Who is totally wiped out.
Gone.
But, you know, lucky us.
We have Santa Claus conquers the Martians.
I can't wait to hear your plot dissection, Chris. I've been waiting all day to hear this.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, as Lydia alluded to, we open up with a broadcast of Kid TV, and we are, I think, surprised to learn that it's Martian children that are watching the broadcast.
I'm going to jump in right away and just want to comment how Star Trek this scene is, because you see the TV screen, which everybody's used to, and then as the camera kind of pans around, it is a flat screen TV on the wall. It's predicting the future, just like Star Trek did. And it's brilliant, because that was the first thing that caught my attention. I thought, oh my goodness, this is, I'm sure, an inspiration for somebody. You know, somebody a decade ago was like, oh, let's pull out our favorite Christmas horrible movie, and they watch it and they go, oh, hey, I work for Sony or whoever came up with flat screen TVs. That's a great idea. You know, that came from this movie. But yeah, total flat screen TV on the wall. Actually, there's a good chance, since this was 1964, that they saw it on Star Trek and went, we should use that for our Martians.
I think Star Trek came later.
I thought it started in 63, but I could be mistaken.
No, that's Doctor Who. Star Trek started up in the late 60s there. So they probably watched this and said, hey, we should
there
have flat
go.
Screens too.
They were like, yeah. Hey, if the Martians can do it, we can do it.
Well, Kid TV goes to has an exclusive interview with Santa Claus himself at the North Pole at his workshop. And we get to meet the jolly old elf himself as he's busy making toys. The on-the-spot reporter, Andy Henderson, I think his name is, the Ned Wertheimer that we were talking about just a little bit ago.
Made famous by Pirates of the Caribbean. Now, I was confused.
Yeah, 60 years later.
I was confused by this scene because he is such a bad actor. I'm just going to come out and say that. It is such horrible acting. I thought that he was like intentionally on a set somewhere, you know, pretending to be at Santa's workshop. But no, turns out, as we find out later in the film, he is supposedly actually at the North Pole, but it looks like this horrible kid TV program. His like,
yeah, that's exactly what I was gonna say.
So bad. You're thinking, oh yeah, this is just, you know, fake made up 1960s TV in a movie. No, it actually is just really bad acting in a movie.
Hi, kids. This is Andy Henderson at the North Pole. Woo, it's cold up here. From this spot, there's only one direction you can go, and that's south. Living up here is pretty rough. I don't see how Santa stands it. Since we've been here, we've eaten nothing but frozen food. At least that's the way it is by the time we get it. And now, let's take a look-see into Santa's workshop.
Definitely was you felt like he was playing down to the kiddies.
Yeah. Yes. Thoughts, Barry?
I to cut this movie a real break. I love that from the very beginning, we are meant to take all this at face value. We are in Santa's workshop. We're looking at Martians. There's no cynicism at all. I mean, this film is clearly tailored for children who will go, oh, yeah, that is Santa's workshop. Oh, yeah, those are truly Martians. There's something so purely unironic about this film that it's really, you know, years and years later of cynicism and postmodernism that we look at this film and, you know, we chuckle at it. But as children, I can understand how this would be very enticing to a child.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, I almost said that.
Absolutely. Yeah, this movie creates its own universe and just relishes in it.
It's weird. It's like a caricature of 1960s reality made in the 1960s. But Barry's right. It's meant to be taken literally.
Well, while we're in Santa's workshop, he's looking at they're talking about some of the new toys that they're coming up with, and I forget which elf came up with it, but came up with a little doll that looks like a Martian, amazingly like the Martians we were about to meet.
Amazingly like Darth Vader.
And a little bit like
Darth Vader. Did anybody else notice? I just went, wait. And again, you have to wonder how much of an influence this movie had on later films and TV shows.
But it does lead both Santa and the newsman to ponder whether if there's a Martian Santa to spread goodwill and joy to all the children on Mars.
And they certainly hope so.
Yes. Well, back on Mars, we meet Kymar, leader of Mars, and his, butler, servant, Droppo?
Droppo.
Yeah. Kymar does not seem to be a very friendly man right from the start. He catches Droppo sleeping on the floor and is rather rude in awakening him.
Well, I think they're kind of establishing. I think they're kind of establishing their relationship as, you know, a master butler, master servant, you know, or boss and employee, and also establishing Droppo as a major
the goofball.
I'm trying to think of a nice way to say it.
A Droppo.
Yeah. Who I firmly maintain that he got his name because he was dropped on his head as a child. That's the only explanation for how weird this guy is. Especially as the movie wears on and things get goofier. It's brain damage. That's my only answer for it.
The learning machine got unplugged at some point.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, Droppo is to this movie what Chunk is to the Goonies. He's established as somebody who's on the villain side, but over the course of the film, there's something lovably, and I use lovably in quotations, there's something lovably goofy about Droppo, if you could put it that way.
He is the comic relief. Very clearly is the comic relief.
Supposedly the comic relief, yes.
Well, comic in quotes.
Yes.
And certainly not on the villain side. Where do you get that, Barry? He was never a baddie. His actions tend to favor the bad guys at some point, but not through any true, evil intent.
Yeah, well, I would say he's like, you know, just like Chunk was a member of the Fratelli Brothers, but he was, you know, clearly on the side of the children from start to beginning.
Sloth.
And in that way, Droppo.
I think you mean Sloth.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I was going, Chunk isn't a bad guy. What do you
Fratelli. I'm so sorry. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, and I see what you need. He's on the side of the children, meaning as in, like, we're still looking at as Kymar is kind of the sort of a villain, and the children are really the good guys, the ones that you're rooting for in this film.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sorry.
Oh, I gotcha.
Okay, so I'm going to get back to the whole, you know, we meet Drambo as he's sleeping, gets awakened by Kymar. Wow. Mm-hmm. And with a tickle ray.
Drambo, you lazy good-for-nothing, where are you? Drambo, wake up! Wake up! Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chief Kymar, sir.
Drambo, you are the laziest man on Mars. Why are you sleeping during working hours?
I wasn't sleeping, Chief. It's just that I haven't been able to sleep these last few nights. I forgot how. So I was just practicing.
Well, I suggest you practice doing your work.
But we learn a little bit more about Kymar as he engages what has become the bane of my work existence. He initiates a conference call, which, think about it, it's the 1960s, and he's just talking, and he can talk to all these different people. It's incredible technology for the era. We take it for granted. But again, you know, this movie in some ways is well ahead of its time.
Oh, I love the insights you see in these things, Lydia.
I know. I'm special.
Kymar the one with the Ron Burgundy mustache?
No, you're thinking of Volmar.
The president is...
The Kymar is the leader. He's the dad of the two Martian children.
And they mentioned at some point that he is the leader of Mars, of the Martians.
Yes, well, Kymar is in like... or K-I-M-A-R, King Martian.
Oh, like Kymar, yeah.
And yes... And his lovely wife, Momar, or Mom Martian.
Now you're just thinking too hard, Christopher.
I am not. Well, Kymar is worried about the Martian children. Apparently all over Mars, kids are just being really sad and wistful. They can't get them to do anything. They just sit around watching Earth programs all day long.
Those awful Earth programs.
Yeah. Well, following the suggestions of his wife, Momar, he and the council, who he calls on the conference call, as you say, decide to go seek the advice from Kochem, an 800-year-old sage.
Okay. I saw the name in the credits, and I couldn't place him.
Yes, Kochem is the wise old man that lives in the forest, as they do.
And he serves the profound purpose of pointing out. Now, I thought his name was Voldar. Is it Vomar? The bad guy.
It is Vomar. They're all...
Vomar, okay.
Yeah.
He serves the indispensable...
Oh, you're right. It is Voldar.
Is it Voldar? I thought it was. Yep. I thought maybe I'd written it down wrong. But he serves the purpose of pointing out that Voldar is a bad guy because they're all standing around waiting for Kymar to show up. And at one point he says, Voldar says, this is a waste of time. I don't even know why we're here. And one of the guys says, you can't dismiss the wisdom of centuries. And Voldar says, I can.
Yeah.
That right there, you know, we're establishing him for the six-year-old children that are captivated by this film as the bad guy.
Yes. I've got the mustache.
Yeah.
Now, do you think Kochem is another name pun?
Oh,
as
no.
As in he who coaches?
Gosh, no. Why would you think that?
I actually read somewhere, and I'd have to try to dig it up real quick. I actually read that Kochem is a Yiddish word.
Wow.
And let me see if I can find it really quick.
So many layers to Santa Claus conquers the Martians.
Layers. Layers upon layers.
Like an ogre.
Yeah, apparently Kochem is according to Wiki now, take that with a grain of salt. Is a Yiddish word meaning genius.
Oh.
Now, I could look that up further, but I'm not going to bother.
No, I will definitely believe that. I've heard that writers will look for names for their characters that actually mean what they're supposed to be representing. So that makes sense.
Oh, so you knock me for King Mar and Mom Martian. But you're cool with Kochum.
Well, you know, the Kimar and the Momar are a little, they're kind of obvious.
Okay.
Except that I didn't pick up on it. So well done, Christopher. Well done.
Well, the wise old man, he tells them that about this time of year on Earth is, you know, early December and nearing the time of happiness called the Christmas.
What is a Christmas?
It's a time that is where apparently of anticipation and joy and well-being all over Earth.
Wow.
What has this to do with our children, Ancient One?
We have no children on Mars. They have children's bodies, but with adult minds. They do not have a childhood. I see this coming for centuries. They are born. Our electronic teaching machines are attached to their brains while they are in their cradles. Information is fed into their minds in a constant stream. And by the time they can walk, they are adults. They've never played. They've never learned to have fun. And now they are rebelling.
What do you advise?
The children must be allowed to be children again. They must learn to play. They must learn what it means to have fun. We need a Santa Claus on Mars.
Children's bodies but adult minds. I love that line. And
yes.
I thought, well, you know where my brain went with it, but all the same.
It sounds kind of creepy to me, guys. It really
very
does.
Very creepy.
A little creepy.
That's where
a little
I'm
creepy.
Going with it, too. Creepy.
Yeah.
And he makes a comment, and I'm sidetracking a little bit with this, but he says information is fed into their minds in a constant stream. And again, I went, oh, okay, foretelling the future. All they do is just sit and get info. We just absorb information, but don't actually practice knowledge. And that's exactly, I think it's, you know, foretelling the future for us.
I did find it odd. I wondered if it was just coincidence or if there was a writer or writers involved in this that kind of had this concern with with computers just starting to come into play in the early 60s and, you know, television becoming more and more centerpiece of our life.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you do wonder if there is a little bit of commentary really intended in here, unless you're Barry, in which case you completely dismiss it.
Completely dismiss it. Do either of you have it in front of you how many screenwriters this film had? I'm curious how many people were smoking Shiba when they wrote this.
I have not pulled that information.
I only see two writing credits.
Okay.
They were staff writers for whatever TV station this came out on. I don't know. I'm speculating. But it wouldn't surprise me.
I do believe this was actually a film production. This was put out in the theater.
Yeah, it did get a theatrical release. I can vouch for that.
Yeah.
Wow. Were you there, Barry?
I was not, but apparently a lot of drive-ins have carried this movie.
Wow, interesting.
Well, Kochum tells him that Mars needs a Santa Claus. And so the council member Voldar disagrees with this, but Kimar decides he's going to head off to Earth, that Earth has had Santa Claus long enough, and it's time for him to come to Mars. And that right there, that sounds like an action film tagline there.
Just Mars.
get your claws to Mars.
Oh, no.
Well, Kimar and crew, including Voldar, I'm going to say his name wrong because I got it incorrect in all my notes now, head off to Earth, and they are initially confused, you know, as from orbit they're scanning the city and discover many, many Santas all over the streets. Of course, they're seeing all the Santas ringing the bells by the buckets looking for donations and such. Well, they land and they stumble across Billy and Betty. And they tell these Martians of the real Santa at the North Pole, that all these other guys are just his helpers. Well, Vodar grabs the kids after this and tells Kymar that they can't let the authorities know that Martians have kidnapped Santa. Kymar somewhat reluctantly agrees, and they leave for the North Pole.
Dun, dun, dun.
Well, I think about this time we discover that Droppo has stowed away aboard the Martian spacecraft. We discover that at some point or another,
yes,
anyway.
I think just before they land, and he's been hiding out in the radar box, which is conveniently labeled radar box.
Radar box. Well, think Batman. You know, think the Batcave. Yeah. Well, Droppo, who has stowed away, gives the kids a tour of the ship. And, of course, then they have to hide in the same radar box as people are starting to come up from the navigation deck. And they overhear the Martians' plan to kidnap Santa and take him to Mars. So they disable the radar screen that protects them from Earth's radars before escaping to warn Santa.
And I have to say, at this point, I'm a big fan of Billy's. Billy? Yeah, Billy. Mm-hmm. I get confused if it's Billy or Bobby. Billy. I'm Billy. A big fan of this kid because he not only is the better of the two actors.
That's very generous.
This is. I don't think it is. I think if you're strictly comparing, you know, Billy to Betty, Billy is far and away the better actor. But, I mean, this kid, he's, what, 7, 8 years old, and he has the presence of mind to disable the radar on an alien ship. This is a smart kid. If we are going to be attacked by aliens, I want him on my team.
Well, he does have that kind of Bill Mumy quality about him.
Yes, very good comparison.
Thank you.
Oh, I totally agree. If I only knew who that was.
That is the star of the superior Invaders from Mars, not related to this film in any way.
Oh, see,
and this is, and the child actor of Lost in Space.
Oh, see, and this is where you guys make me sound like an idiot child. So I bow to your wisdom and knowledge.
Wasn't Bill Mumy the mutant kid on that episode of Twilight Zone? It's a wonderful, it's a good life where he's got all the powers.
Yes, that's also him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, I love that kid.
Yeah.
Back up a little bit, totally unrelated to the plot, but yet somehow included in the movie, is the fact that the Air Force is tracking some unidentified thing from space. And
it's true.
Which suddenly abruptly disappears, which we find out is due to the radar box. And
yes.
And like Billy and Betty, everything seems to be disappearing today. So, but you know, we do kind of have that little push of for some. Honestly, I think that was taken for granted as a part of that time period. It was, you know, the mid-60s. You know,
the UFO scares of the time.
The UFO scares. World War II is not that far, you know, far in the distant past. You've got Russia as the Cold War thing is starting to really get going. And, you know, you've got the duck and cover commercials, all this stuff going on, you know, and it's kind of, I think, almost what makes this more of a science fiction than a fantasy is the fact that they really do pull in all of that amazing technology of the 1960s that at that time was cutting edge. You know, we can, you know, watch stuff as it's coming in from space, and, you know, we are tracking it with our radar and all this stuff.
Oh, right. Yes, absolutely.
And even to this day, NORAD actually does track Santa every Christmas. So to throw this movie a bone, once again, this film is very ahead of its time.
It's true.
Very true.
And maybe that is why NORAD does it, to prevent this from happening again.
They don't want him kidnapped on his route.
No.
Thank you, NORAD. Thank you from all of us.
We'll get the NSA to pass along season's greetings to NORAD.
Right?
For us.
Oh, yeah.
As they're listening to our podcast.
Merry Christmas to all of you at NORAD from Orphan Entertainment.
And the NSA. So they do, though, end up at the North Pole, and, you know, they're going to take – now, I'm going to need your help on this one. They're going to get somebody or something.
Torg,
thank you. I couldn't remember. They're going to get Torg. And Voldar says, is that really necessary for one roly-poly little man? Which I love Voldar's dialogue through this entire thing. And there's one reason I love Voldar's dialogue. And it is because he sounds exactly to a T, with the exception of the voice. But every bit of his dialogue, from the bah or the you will know, everything that he says sounds exactly like Invader Zim. And I love that about him. He's everything he says. I love it. If you can pull any phrase that Voldar says out of this movie and insert it into an Invader Zim episode.
Awesome.
I don't know why I thought of that, but as I was watching it a second time today, I thought, that sounds exactly like Invader Zim.
Oh, he is the lead scenery chewer of the film. That is for sure. He does enjoy this role. Well, I don't know if he enjoyed it, but he makes...
plays it. He and Santa Claus, I think, are really the two strong... I will say Kymar, for being that 1960s father figure, I think does a very good job. I hate to say good job, but you know what I mean. As a credible...
Well, no, because I was actually surprised to find out that he has very few, if any, other acting roles, because honestly, he really felt like, to me, like the one I recognized as being, I had to have seen him in something else.
Kymar, yeah.
Yeah, he was, like you put it, the quintessential 60s dad.
Yeah, he really.
And I'm thinking he had to be on some movie, some TV show, and he wasn't. This was like his last or second to last film role.
Yeah, and he only had 3 or 4, I think. So
yeah,
but he and Voldar, for being the bad guy in a kid's movie, I think does a very good job. And I was kind of surprised to find myself thinking, wow, that Santa's kind of legit.
not bad.
Not too bad, no. So I, even though there is a lot of kind of ridiculous stuff going on and some very just exceptionally bad acting from a few people, there are a couple of actual credible parts in this movie.
Well, the Martians, after realizing Billy and Betty are gone, send Torg to go after him. We still haven't seen Torg yet. Don't know what Torg is, but shortly thereafter, as the kids are trying to hide in a cave, and oh my gosh, I didn't even put it in my notes, but I just remembered the polar bear attack.
Oh my gosh, that's the best.
I have to go to Kymar saying, I love it, because you know that Martian technology is super advanced, because not only can you give whatever Torg one command to get him to do something, you can give it to him twice. Torg, come out of the spaceship. Come out of the space. I love it. I think I'm going to make that my ringtone. But I love that, though. That apparently Martian technology is not, it's about as reliable as our technology, because you have to tell it to do everything twice.
A little bit like Siri.
Yeah. You gotta, I'm sorry. Did you say stay in the spaceship? No.
But yes, the polar bear attack, the so painfully obvious man in a suit.
And it sounds like a lion the whole time. He's like, arr. And I was like, I don't remember bears sounding like that.
Yes, the bear with knees and a where you could actually see the head as it overlaps the body. Yeah, it was quite a thing of beauty.
I
gotta hand it to this movie. I gotta give this movie some credit here. They could have gotten any form of stock footage for the bear, but no, they put a man in a suit, and somehow it's creepier.
It's actually kind of creepy. But it was funny that this was the scene in the movie that made me think, I wish somebody would remake this movie. I thought I would love to see that. Okay, let me think a moment before I make an absolute fool of myself and say this out loud. I feel like they could remake this movie with decent special effects and some decent actors and actually have a passable modern movie.
a fun new holiday take on a old classic.
I really wanted to see a real polar bear. Now, you know, again, Billy and Betty not doing a great job of being freaked out by a bear. They just go, shh, be quiet, you know. most kids I know would scream, you know, which is at least scream, if nothing else. But
remember, this is, you know, the kids' movie. And so the kids have to be... They have to be the brave. They're the stars of the film.
Yeah, you don't, you know, in the 1960s, you can't terrify children the way you can today.
No. No, and today they would have, like, you know, ripped poor Betty to pieces. And then Billy would have gone on a rampage of vengeance.
Right, yeah. Like, put a deer head on his, tied it on as a hat or something.
Yeah, the man in the polar bear costume attack scene, definitely not as intense as the T-Rex attack scene in Jurassic Park.
I don't know. There were those parallels.
It worked for Lydia.
I know. I was scared.
Well, Torg, as it turns out, is a giant robot or man in a cardboard box.
You said robot.
I said robot.
I just had to point out, you said robot.
I think you said robot.
I see. We both heard robot.
I heard robot.
Fine. I said, fine. It's a giant robot. Or what would definitely be the type of robot a kid would make out of a refrigerator box and a couple of soup cans.
I'm going to run with a bucket on the head. I think that's what I'm going to say.
Yes, bucket on the head.
Some of
absolutely.
That really great dryer venting, the metal circular hose that vents your dryer.
It's still more convincing than the polar bear.
It does light up. And I mean, to the point where it can be mistaken for Santa's workshop.
Yes. Yeah, on the horizon, the lights are coming closer.
And then this is where I will make my argument for Betty being the worst actor, because she looked like the most bored, yawning child I've ever seen when this robot is coming toward her, stalking her, about to attack her. She's like,
She is stunned with fear.
She's stunned with something, that's for sure. Stunned with a stupid stick. Betty, if you're out there.
Sorry.
Yeah, not really, but yeah.
Well, Torg captures the kids. Voldar tries to get the robot to crush him and kill him.
But robot again.
Robot. I heard it too.
I heard robot. But he does. Voldar says, destroy them. Destroy them, Torg. And Kymar shows up and says, aha, I knew you would do something like that, so I programmed it to only listen to my voice.
Probably two or three times, just to be safe.
Right? Only listen to my voice. Only listen.
My voice.
No, mine. But I love it. This is where I love Billy's gumption. You can see he's really the fighter, and he says, you won't get away with this, you Martian. Yeah, it's telling him, dude. I'm going to come up with Billy's school of insults. And moving forward from this episode on, we are going to have Billy's school of insults, and starting off with, you Martian.
All right, I like it.
It's coming. Wait for it. Next episode, listeners, you're going to hear it. I got really excited about that. Sorry.
Now that the kids are once again in their grasp, they send Torg to capture Santa Claus. Torg busts through the workshop door, but unfortunately, as soon as he enters Santa's workshop, he becomes a toy.
That is such a badass entrance, though. I gotta say, him busting through Santa's workshop, that's the most surreal thing I've seen all year.
It's like Christmas at Ground Zero.
It is. It's awesome.
I do like the elves that spring into action and just, hey, you can't come in here. It's not allowed.
And then I love it. It goes, poof. Oh, wait, no, that's later.
That's true. After it turns into a toy, and Santa claims that, you know, what a great looking toy and so well made.
I love it. They're treating him like a toy, and he is one. I was totally waiting for a dun dun dun. I guess Rudolph and the claymation abominable snowman were off that day.
You're hoping for a Rance Bancroft.
I wanted a Rance Bass Rankin. Thank you.
Bass Rankin. There it is.
Bass Rankin. Yes. Back to the robot.
Well, the Martians bust in, and yes, using their pop guns, freeze a couple of the elves and Mrs. Claus.
And but I love Santa's reply. Oh, why did you have to do that? And they say, oh, don't worry, it'll wear off in a little while.
Oh, why didn't you say so in the first place?
But I love it when they shoot Mrs. Claus. He says, well, my dear, I can't recall a time when you were so silent for so long. Thereby confirming the fact that Mrs. Claus is a total biatch. We knew this. It's proven in everything except for the Chipmunks Christmas special that Mrs. Claus is just a pain in the backside.
Poor
eat,
Mrs.
Santa,
Claus.
Eat! We've all heard it. Who ever heard of a skinny Santa? I'm sorry, I'm having flashbacks to my childhood.
Yeah, now we brought up old Rudolph and stuff.
I know. It's that dun-dun-dun every time.
Yep. Well, at this time, now Mrs. Claus apparently reports to the authorities that Santa Claus has been kidnapped by Martians, and Earth joins forces to go after them and rescue Santa from those evil Martian monkeys.
And Mrs. Santa Claus has positively identified the kidnappers as Martians. Never in the history of mankind have the nations of the world reacted with such unanimity and cooperation. Tonight, the lights will burn until dawn in the United Nations building as the leaders of the world map a course of action. And at Cape Kennedy, our correspondent interviewed Werner von Green, the man in charge of America's Starshot program.
Mr. von Green, what is the space agency doing about this?
Well, they have mobilized all the men and equipment in our Starshot project. And we have rushed our astronauts into an intensive program for the final phase of their training. Now, our Starshot ship is supposed to undergo 6 months of test flights. But we are going to forget about the testing and go after those Martian monkeys.
Isn't that risky?
Of course it is risky. But every one of our astronauts is begging for the chance to go after the Martians. Who wouldn't give everything to bring Santa back to our children?
I'm sorry, I thought it was fun.
It is. I can't believe I'm listening to this.
Well, and this is where I think it's worth mentioning that the wise man on Mars and the wise man on Earth are in fact the same wise man.
You think so?
According to the credits.
Oh, okay.
The German doctor and...
Yeah.
What was his name?
Cochum?
Yep, are the same actor.
Oh, interesting.
I thought that was interesting, too, that he's kind of takes the place of the narrator by being the all-seeing, all-knowing German doctor / Martian wise guy.
Right. Okay, interesting. Well, Santa on the ship, who apparently is just having a great old time and telling jokes to the Martians. Hey, Lydia and Barry.
Yeah.
What's small and round, and you put it on a stick, and you put it on a fire, and it's green?
Well, my answer is not appropriate. What's yours, Barry?
Likewise, not appropriate. What's the answer, Chris?
A Martian mellow.
Oh, my gosh. That's really funny in the movie.
Pardon
apparently
me,
they
died.
Don't have jokes on Mars.
Yeah, no, apparently not. Because that is definitely that is the kind of joke that a 3-year-old would tell
that
you.
That actually is exactly the kind of joke that a 1960s kid who has never seen a Martian before would think is hilarious.
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 Well, Voldemar continues to voice his disdain for Santa, but he decides he pretends to play nice and give Santa and the kids a tour of the ship, and then locks them in the airlock, which he then tries to jettison them into space, proving that he is indeed a very evil Martian.
Yeah, that's pretty sick stuff, I must say.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, I do like the fact that he gets up to the command deck and flicks the big switch, and 30 seconds later, the door will open and jettison and empty the airlock.
Now,
and,
I'm going to come back again to just wondering how much of an influence this movie was on later films, because I distinctly recall a very similar moment in Aliens. I'm just saying.
Wow. All right.
Star Trek, Star Wars, Aliens, the list goes on and on.
All due thanks to Santa Claus Conquers
the Martians. This is the first one I recall seeing that had that. And tell me if you can think of an earlier one. I'd be very interested to know.
I would say The Terror from Beyond, I think it was. Yeah. I don't know what year that came out, but that involved some airlock action. Yeah.
This movie is so bizarre. I kind of wondered if it would actually happen. He makes the threat, and I thought, you know what? Santa could die. This film is so bizarre.
It's so intense.
But I did like the scene where Kymar comes in, and who's in the airlock? No one anymore.
It's such a great Invader Zim line. And I just want him to be like, mwah, mwah, mwah. He doesn't do it, though.
No, he does need a good old maniacal laugh at some point.
He does.
Well, it turns out that old Santa has a few tricks up his sleeve, and apparently he saves him and the kids with a very much just a, well, how'd you get out? Or they apparently described they went up the air shaft.
And I have to admit, for a plot device, this is not something I ever would have thought of, but that's classic Santa escape. I mean, that's the only way Santa could ever escape from anything would be by going up the chimney. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And it seemed, again, going back to the kids film thing, that would be a fantastic moment for any kid. Oh, there you went up the chimney. Ha,
and I was thinking, how are they going to get out of this? You know, Billy's doing this great job. He's looking around. He's trying to find some way to get out. Weirdly, I think that it's one of those great surprise moments where you go, oh, I should have seen that coming, but I didn't.
Well played, Santa. Well played.
Well, Voldar is taken under arrest for trying to kill Santa and the kids, but of course, thanks to Droppo, escapes once they arrive on Mars. Billy and Betty move in with the Martians, and he meets Bomar and Germar.
I feel like that should be a movie itself. Billy and Betty move in with the Martians. Or at least like a TV show episode. It's
The Third Rock from the Sun, I think, is what you're thinking.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, of course, and they also meet Santa, who gets everybody laughing. They've never heard them laugh before, and this is the first time that they've fallen asleep without the sleep spray.
I want a sleep spray.
That is the most astonishing line in this movie. The first time they've fallen asleep without the sleep spray. If that isn't creepy, folks.
Well, they do, you know, show you how to use it. You have to first make the kid lay down on this round table, which we assume is a bed, and then you push a button and it goes boop.
Still creepy.
In today's world, it was the first time that they've fallen asleep without the NyQuil.
Oh, God, that's awful. Children's Tylenol, that's why it's off the shelves, guys. Oh, my goodness. That's so true.
Well, Kymar lets Santa know that you're going to set up a workshop for him, and Santa's eager to get going so he can get back before Christmas Eve.
Santa, tomorrow we'll set up a workshop for you. It won't be exactly the same as the one you have on Earth, but I'm sure it'll serve your purpose.
Good, good. Now, I'd like to get going and have the toy shop operating full blast so as I can return to Earth for Christmas. You know, Mrs. Claus is a very good-natured woman, but...
Santa Claus... You will never return to Earth.
Oh, yeah.
Now you belong to Mars.
Ho, ho, ho.
Dun, dun, dun.
Very ominous. Voldar plots in a cave while Santa and the kids while away at the new automated toy factory. Voldar decides that they can't get the Santa because he's always under guard, so they want to try to discredit him to make it so he's... to discredit him.
Sounds logical.
Why would you want to discredit him?
But you kind of notice at this point that all of the Earthlings, including Santa, are getting a little kind of down in the dumps. Santa says, my finger is tired from pushing the buttons.
Oh, me, the great toy maker, sitting around pushing buttons. Automation.
You know, we're going to go to bed instead of watching TV. Oh, what's wrong? Nothing. We're just tired.
Right, yes. And Momar, once again, can't you tell? They're homesick. They miss their parents. They miss their friends. You have to send them back. Impossible.
It made me want to break into that song from, you know, the TV version of Cinderella. But, you know, back to Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Impossible
for a plain yellow pumpkin to become a golden carriage. And Lizzie.
Meanwhile, back at Santa Claus, back at Mars, Droppo tries to try on. He decides to try on some of Santa's clothes. And because his finger isn't tired, he goes to build more toys, and he's mistaken by Voldar and the thugs as the real Santa Claus. They happen to be at the shop sabotaging it.
Which made me wonder, sabotage, isn't that a French word? Do they have sabotage?
I think it's like a
Dutch word.
Dutch,
from
I think,
the,
isn't
from,
it?
You know, sabot, which is the wooden shoes that they threw into the machinery to... Sabotage.
Thanks, Star Trek.
I know, right? Oh, man, again, coming back to all the influence from this movie. Sabotage. But they do capture Droppo.
Yeah, so they capture Droppo and take him back to the cave. And now that they think they have Santa, they're going to threaten to kill him unless Kaimar agrees to send him and the kids home and stop all this nonsense about happiness and joy and laughter. But when they get to the toy shop, Voldar is surprised to find that Santa is happily working away at the toy store or the toy shop. What do you want to call it? The workshop.
Workshop.
Of course, the sabotage does work. They're getting the dolls with like mixed up heads.
Teddy bear heads. And yeah.
Yeah. It's a baseball bat with a tennis racket on the end of it. So, yeah. So they know that they've been someone's been messing around with the machinery. Well, Droppo manages to escape by cleverly switching the light bulbs on the nuclear
use of
curtain.
Light bulbs, I love that. He's like, oh, it just switches the light bulbs, and there you go. He can walk out through this nuclear curtain that would otherwise disintegrate him. Brilliant.
Exactly.
Brilliant.
And I'm a little disappointed. We never saw the curtain disintegrate anything.
That's
how could you
true.
Do that?
Yeah, I kept kind of expecting at least some really bad fake shimmer effects.
Yeah. A demo. Let me show you what'll happen.
Yeah,
and throw
a baseball
nothing.
Or something through it. Pew, pew, pew. Didn't happen.
Well, Santa and the kids come up with a plan. Actually, I guess
Kaimar.
At this time, let's see. Yeah, Kaimar captures Voldar, but the Voldar turns the tables on him in the store closet.
I love this moment. This is that '60s surfer music. It's so good.
Oh, and it's even the gun. He's holding his gun hand. He just happens to be holding his gun hand over, like, the, I don't know, the surfboard
or
whatever.
It looks like a ski or something like that. And he
bangs it so it knocks up and hits the game. Yeah, you just want to hear, Mannix! Yeah. Oh. Well, Billy overhears Voldar in his evil plan to go and finish off Santa for good. And Santa and the kids hatch a little plot to ambush him with all their toys. Just as he comes into the workshop, they just hit him with a barrage of toys and pop guns.
And you know what? I have to give credit to this movie at this point again, because as any mother of more than three children knows, this is actually possible. You can really incapacitate somebody with enough toys.
Absolutely. But I do want to point out, 1 hour and 15 minutes. This is when an actor really begins to question his agent's abilities. I feel so sorry for the man who plays Voldar, who has to stand there and, don't hit me.
Oh, no, the little toy drums are drumming at me.
Yeah.
What?
The army tank. Army? What?
Yeah.
Mars? Yeah, I love how all the Martian kids are really into Earth toys.
I thought it was interesting that the doll was dressed like an Earth doll.
Well, maybe it's because it's that new fad. They've all been watching the Earth program.
That actually
so
would make sense, yeah.
Exactly. Well, Voldar is captured, and Droppo is elected as Mars' new Santa Claus. So our Santa and the kids get to head back for home, and everyone lives happily ever after.
Hooray for Santa Claus. I don't know the rest of it, or I would keep singing it, but as far as original film score themes go, I think this song is probably the worst I've ever heard.
It is the worst, but I mean, admit it. Don't you kind of, when you're listening to it, though, you do kind of just start little bopping a little bit?
Oh, yeah, it's just like the song that never ends. It just gets stuck in your head. Oh, my goodness.
Exactly.
I've been walking around the house humming it for the last, you know, oh, gosh, I don't even know how long, but it's awful.
It is really rough, and I'm sure it will find its way into this podcast. but no, that was Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
And I love it. They kind of allude to the idea that Santa Claus takes the kids back in a spaceship, but they never kind of, you don't know what happens. You know, are Billy and Betty's parents, did they remember them? How long have they been gone? Has it been a few days or has it been years and years? Yeah,
well, I
assume not years and years because they're still
alive. No, I think it's been, but it had to have been several days, if not weeks, because it was early December, and now they'll get home just in time for Christmas Eve.
Yeah,
exactly. Lots of open-ended questions. What happened to all, you know, all the astronauts? They show the rockets taking off from Earth to go after the Martians.
And then they never catch them. And then did Santa Claus use the spaceship to go and deliver the toys? Or does he, you know, go back to the sleigh in the end? Because they do mention in the beginning that it's possible that Santa Claus will be delivering him with a rocket sled. And he says, no, I'm going to be using the old-fashioned way. And then at the end, he comes back in the spaceship.
Yeah, but and now he's under the wire. I mean, is he going to have to go back to the
I think it's important. And while he's delivering those toys, does the spaceship have a critical malfunction and explode over a major city population and possibly injure or kill people?
Or perhaps a small town in New Mexico?
There are big questions left at the end of this movie. I think it's important to really pay attention to that. I think there's a lot of potential for a sequel.
You two have given this movie more thought than screenwriters ever did.
Well, I have given it some thought, and maybe too much, but it is the kind of thought that, you know, and why this film is often considered so bad is because, like I was saying before, obviously it's a horrible science fiction film. And I think it honestly kind of fails as a Christmas film, too, because in most... I mean, you think of any other Christmas film, there has got to be some lesson learned by somebody. Mm-hmm. There are no lessons learned in this film.
Yeah, there are no warm, fuzzy feelings. There's
no absolutely
moment
not.
Of epiphany.
Unless it's the all work and no play, but we get that in the first 20 minutes of the film. Mm-hmm. So then we have to sit through another hour waiting for more. Mm-hmm. And the only other thing I can think of is kidnapping is okay so long as you return them when you're done.
That's awesome. Well, I was going to run with, you know, something along the lines of children need to play to be happy and will miss their parents if they get kidnapped. I really don't know. And also Mrs. Claus is a major biatch. I think that's one of the major underlying things.
That's what you've taken from this film out of everything. Mrs. Claus is a bit of a nag.
Yeah, it's indisputable. Yeah. I mean, you know, just she never.
I find the subtext of this film really creepy. I mean, these are aliens with tickle rays and sleep spray for starters. To get back to Mrs. Claus, I mean, I kind of agree with Lydia, although I got to say, there's a moment we didn't discuss. It's early in the film where she realizes she's on TV and she acts like a little girl meeting Justin Bieber for the first time. She loses her mind when she realizes she's on television.
Well, bear in mind,
why didn't you tell me my hair is a mess?
This was before, you know, most people had the opportunity to be on television just for eating their weight in chocolate cake or... you know, having some kind of neuroses that would get them on the Jerry Springer show. So, you know, maybe there's a little bit of, I got to give her a little leeway there, but yeah.
Yeah, but it's Mrs. Claus. I mean, this is a celebrity.
That's fair. You know what? And I don't think that celebrities have the right to, for their own privacy. I'm totally kidding here. I did notice also that when Martians surrender, they do it like ballerinas. So the hands.
Oh, yes, they did. Yeah. The hands over their head. Yeah.
So maybe that's really the message. I got nothing, guys.
Okay,
I got nothing.
Yeah. I think that's pretty obvious. Yeah.
I appreciate the enthusiasm both of you have for this movie. I really do. And I got to say, God bless you, Chris. Your recitation. Your recitation of the screenplay, plot point by plot point, I've half the time I just sat here thinking, wow, this is astonishing. I've actually seen this, and this actually makes some kind of sense. I can't believe we actually went over the plot of Santa Claus Conquers the Martians point by point.
Barry, You're welcome.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to all.
And God bless us, everyone.
Everyone. Did anybody else notice that Santa Claus actually had the most sinister laugh of anybody in this movie? And he kind of looked like Johnny Carson.
I did not catch the Johnny Carson. I thought his laugh occasionally kind of fell into Mr. Magoo a few times. But and maybe a little sinister here and there.
Yeah.
I thought he was kind of jolly.
He was jolly, but at the end when he is talking to the Martians about how he thwarted their plan to suck him out into space, oh my God, by the way, he has like this laugh that's almost like, it. Can I say
it's
almost like Satan claws?
What kind of claws?
Satan claws.
Satan claws.
Oh,
Black Santa.
Yeah.
Oh no, my brain went somewhere else with that. I wanted him to say, "I am smiling." Oh.
Well, I don't think there's much more we can say about Santa Claus versus Conquers the Martian.
Gosh, no. I think we've said pretty much everything that can be said. And you know what? For you amateur filmmakers out there, again, I just want to press my opinion that this would be a great remake.
It would be. And quite honestly, yeah, I mean, there you go. You can do better. It's going to be hard to do worse.
It would be really difficult to do worse than the original. This is a prime candidate for a makeover. You don't want to remake a Michael Jackson song. Those are already really good. This movie, on the other hand, you could do something special.
Yeah, look at it this way. If any actors you get to be in your film actually go on to do one or two films afterwards,
yeah,
you've already done better than Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
But this was
Wait a minute, our show, this actually lasted longer than the running time of the movie, didn't it?
You know what, we got 6 more minutes and we'll actually hit it.
Wow.
Oh my God. Well, let's try to bring it in under the wire. I think that is going to do it for us this month. Thank you for everything, Lydia and Barry.
Thank you, Christopher.
Thank you, Meli Kaliki Maka.
Also, a thank you to the regular listeners of the podcast, and welcome to any new listeners, including the entire group of hosts from the Creature Feature podcast who have just joined us on our Facebook page. Oh,
nice.
I say welcome to you all.
Yeah.
I hope you continue to download future installments of Orphan Entertainment. You can easily do so by subscribing via iTunes, and while you're there, please rate us and leave us a comment. If you'd like to get in touch with us with any suggestions, comments, or feedback, of course, join us on the aforementioned Facebook page at facebook.com/groups/orphanentertainment, or you can drop us an email at orphanedent@jonja.net, and all the links will be in the show notes. So goodbye until next time, and have a great Christmas and a happy new year, everyone.
Robot.
Merry Christmas.
And robot. Whatever.
Thank you, Santa, for bringing happiness to the children of Mars.
And the Christmas spirit to all of us.
Cern, from the bottom of my heart, I wish you and yours the very best of everything. Goodbye, dear friends.